this week. We are pleased to have Hilary Carteret with us. She's originally from the UK, but she came to Canada for a postdoc at the IQC, and she's just returned from a career break thanks to the APS M. Hildred Lewitt Fellowship. She's currently working with Roger Malka. She's going to tell us about how to estimate entanglement negativity from moments of the partially transposed reduced density matrix using the moment problem. So,
right, okay.
Go ahead when you're ready.
Right. So I guess before I start, if I say to people moment problem, how many people know what I'm talking about? Oh.
Well, you
were here for the rehearsal yesterday. Okay. Right. Well, if I say moments of the density matrix, do you know what I'm talking about? Everybody cool with that? Right. So moment problem, it's not actually a problem. It's just that that's the historical name for it. It's a set of methods for solving the moment problem. And so it just got abbreviated to moment problem. And it's basically given all or some, for our purposes, some of the moments of the distribution, what can you say about possible distributions that are consistent with that set of moments? Now, if you've got all of them, you've got a full set of moments, and your distribution lives in a finite range, you either have a single unique solution or no solution. If you've got one of your limits is infinity, then life gets more complicated, but I'm not going to deal with that this afternoon. But if you've only got a finite number of moments, which is a situation you would have if you're, say, using the replica trick in quantum Monte Carlo, or you've got experimental data, then you have a set of solutions in general, and you want to talk about, you know, characterize that set.
Can I just ask a very elementary question? When you say you have all the moments, is that for, like, real exponents or just integer?
That would be integer exponents,
okay.
But I'm not dealing with that situation.
Oh, okay.
Right. I mean, and the analytic methods that I have seen, people start with a full set of moments where, you know, all the integers,
okay.
Right? And they can then use the Stieltjes transform to zip that up into a power series and manipulate it with a machinery of complex analysis. Right? If you don't have a full set of moments, you can't do that. And that makes life unpleasant for a lot of people. So this is what you can do if you only have partial information. So, you know, you don't expect to pin it down to a single unique solution. Obviously, you want to test whether your moments are consistent with a solution, because if you're doing, say, well, either experiment or Monte Carlo, you're going to have issues with statistical noise. If your input data is too noisy, then the method may fail and you would like it to tell you, you know, no, you need cleaner data, rather than simply producing nonsense. Okay, so why are we I'll get on to why are we doing this? There's a lot of interest in entanglement across boundaries. And I'd start here, I think. The sort of archetypal situation for that is I have a kind of global system which is pure, or it has to be with existing methods. I have a subsystem of interest, right? And the first thing you do is you look at entanglement across the cap. Now, this will also pick up entanglement that's rather longer range, but it can't distinguish it from the short range entanglement. So if you look at, say, Renyi entropies or von Neumann entropies, that's what you get. Certainly Renyi entropies. Von Neumann entropies, there's this construction. There's the Kataev-Pressel construction and there's the Levin-Wen construction, which is generally viewed to pick up long-range, well, it does pick up long-range entanglement. The question is, does it pick up long-range order? Unfortunately, as far as I can tell, this method doesn't work for that. And you can't use Renyi entropies in Preskill and Kataev or Levin-Wen because it specifically needs the von Neumann entropy. So this is what we've got. But what we would really like is to be able to have two subsystems of interest. So I'm going to call this C now, because I now got two subsystems of interest. And what I would like, we've still got orange chalk here, right, is to look at the entanglement between these two subsystems. Am I loud enough? Right. So that's what we'd like, because you know, we believe this is related to topological order. Unfortunately, if we try and set this up using either the Renyi entropies or the von Neumann entropies used naively, what we actually pick up is that. Right, and we can't distinguish that. So we can't distinguish that, for example, from that. There's no way of telling those apart. And if A and B are not disjoint, like this, then we just pick up around the edges. And there will be, presumably, some longer range stuff in there, but we can't tell it from the short range stuff. So what we really want is that.
In which sense? Like in a set of mutual information?
Well, if you have an entangled measure that's based on looking at subsystem mixedness, I mean, the early ones do, globally pure system only works if the system is globally pure. You look at a subsystem of interest, you look at how mixed that is, you look at its Schmidt coefficients.
Exactly.
Right? Now, that cannot tell you, right, if your system is mixed, there's any mixing in your global system, it cannot distinguish thermal mixing, other randomness mixing from entanglement. Right, well-known fact that if you have entanglement measures that need global purity and you use them in a system that is not globally pure, they will lie to you. Right, they will cannot distinguish between mixing and entanglement. And so if you have two subsystems, all they can see is the mixing. Right, B can see that it is mixed, right, but it has no idea whether that mixing is due to correlations with C, thermal noise from C, or entanglement with A. Can't tell them apart. So if you specifically want long-range entanglement, you want to get rid of the short-range entanglement, you want long-range entanglement only, you cannot see it with any entropies. It's just a mathematical fact.
I mean, there are measures that capture this correlations between A and B.
Yeah, they're called the negativity. That's why we're trying to estimate it, right? That's why. Right. So yeah, there are approaches to that. I'm going to start by showing how Renyi entropies work. Build this up in stages. Even though Renyi entropies don't actually give us this, because if I dive straight into the construction for moments of the partial transpose, I generally find that confuses people who aren't familiar with the technique. So this is out of a paper by Hastings, Gonzalez, Callen, and Melko from PRL 2010. That's on the archive at okay, so that's Hastings et al. So I can do this various ways. And the way they do it in the paper is graphically in terms of spin chains. So here's your spin chain. And this system is globally pure because it has to be. And I'm going to draw some little spins on this. So initially, so make this an RVB state.
So there's two copies of the...
Yeah, two copies. This is copy one, this is copy two. Right. So think of them as replicas. You're using the replica trick. Now, I'm just going to show the two replicas initially so that you can see the difference. So these are RVB states, so they're not necessarily nearest neighbors. Now, let's make sure I do this right. Messed this up yesterday. Right, so there's the two replicas. Now, in order to get the second order Renyi entropy, well, the general expression for Renyi entropies is this. Second order Renyi entropy, n is 2. Okay, so this will give you that. So I'll put the dots in again. This is A. where I don't know if you can see this dashed line over here. This is B, the rest of the system.
Hillary is not important, but that formula, you want to have a log in there.
Oops, yep. It is important, but yeah. thanks for spotting that. I don't actually, the negativity, well, I'm doing the linear version. There is a logarithmic version. I'll define the negativity in a minute. So I'll do this and then define negativity. That's what I left the space for. Now what you do is you swap this half only and not that one. And then you take the expectation value. So these ones are unchanged because they are within a single subsystem. And I'm going to use a different color for the others. So this is really just the replica trick done with spin chains. Everybody see how that works? So I've flipped that half, but not this one, right? Whilst leaving the links the same. And take that expectation value, the expectation value of the swap operator on this half, and that gives you and then you can plug that into that formula and you have the Renyi entropies, or the Renyi entropy for order two. If you want to do a higher order one, you just have more replicas and you do a cyclic permutation. Okay. Right, now the negativity, which we should define before we go any further. This is defined in terms of, first of all, you need to divvy up your density matrix into two subsystems here. So we're in this setting. So C has been traced out already. Okay, now with partial transpose is you take your density matrix, you do the transpose on the B subsystem only, right? Not the whole thing. Whole thing, that if you do transpose on the whole thing, it doesn't change the eigenspectrum. You do the transpose on one subsystem, it will leave the eigenspectrum untouched if your system is separable, but it may also throw up negative eigenvalues if your system is distillable. As something complicated happens in the middle where you have bound entanglement, I'm just ignoring that. I'm looking at the negativity because that's something that's easy to calculate. So if something has a negativity of zero, it does not mean that it's necessarily separable, right? It just means that it's not distillable. So you have this object, and you then take its one norm, so actually I should just write that as B. If I use two, it's just going to confuse people. So what this is the sum of the moduli of the eigenvalue, because these can be negative, and that's the multiplicity. So if you have the same eigenvalue appearing twice, you count it twice. Right? So pretty clear with how that is. So a negativity, the linear negativity, which is what I'm going to be using today, doesn't actually matter which subsystem you flip, right? Just pick one and flip it. So what that does is it peels off the positive eigenvalues. And that leaves you with twice the difference, so you halve it. So what this is, another way of saying this is, take all the negative eigenvalues that you get in the spectrum of this and add them up, right? And then take the modulus, right? You ignore the positive eigenvalues. So that's just what this does. You may also see something called the logarithmic negativity, which is just log of this. And you don't need a minus sign out of this. You don't need a minus sign out of here because this is a positive number already. If this thing has, if this sort of lowest value that this one norm can take is one. Okay, so if you have a non-zero negativity, this object will be bigger than one. So, I mean, this is probably that definition is probably familiar to a lot of people, but yesterday not everybody had seen it before. So, right, so nobody happy with what this definition is. This is another thing about negativity. It's an upper bound for the distillable entanglement. As far as anybody knows, it does give the distillable entanglement where in the setting in which it's defined, you have infinitely many copies of the state. So you have infinitely many, Alice and Bob share infinitely many copies of a partially entangled state. And the question is, how many maximally entangled states can I distill out of that by local operations and classical communication? Now, that's perhaps not quite appropriate for a condensed matter setting, but I think there's some result which says you can usually get half of that on a one-shot distillation. So I'm not sure whether that's always true or just the example in that paper. Don't have a reference for that handy. So is everybody happy with how this works? This is often what confuses people. I can write this out in terms of algebra if you want to actually see me grind through it with indices. No? Everybody happy? Right. So I'll skip the bit where you grind through it with indices. I think I've already said this bit. So there's one suggestion is the Kataya-Preskill construction. Another one is Levin-Wen. I can put up references for those if people want. Probably people know this already. But the problem with those two, from the point of view of, say, quantum Monte Carlo, is that they need the von Neumann entropy specifically. And this method of starting from the moments does not seem to give you the von Neumann entropy, or at least I haven't been able to see how to do it without introducing a cutoff, which I think is clunky. And there may be a better method, but as far as I know, there isn't a way of doing it. So that's why we're using the negativity. Right. So another thing, eigenspectrum reconstruction. I need to say a little bit about this. If you have a complete set of moments, as I said, you can reconstruct the eigenspectrum exactly. They're called, well, in finite dimensional case, they're called the Newton-Girard formulae, also known as the Newton relations. And you can just take the moments, plug them into an equation, then it spits out the characteristic equation that we all know and love, and you can then solve that. Now, there's a kind of government health warning with this method in that if you don't have a complete set of moments and you just follow the algorithm and attempt to solve that polynomial, it tends to spray complex numbers everywhere and is completely uninformative. So if we can only afford to compute a small number of moments, or we only have enough quantum control over the system to measure only a few moments and we can't get all of them, it would be nice if we can actually say something about the eigenspectrum. You know, coarse graining would be good. I mean, obviously, there's no such thing as a free lunch. So if you don't have a full set of moments, you're not going to get an exact eigenspectrum unless you are very, very lucky with the shape of that spectrum. But you would like to have a coarse graining that you can use to approximate stuff. So the strategy for estimating a negativity is, one, find a method for finding the moments or measuring the moments. And that's in this earlier paper here. That's set up in terms of quantum circuits, right? Because that was the language that people were speaking about then. It's a quantum information theory paper rather than a condensed matter paper. But it is just this replica trick, right? It's the way the circuits are done, they already trace out the pure section, right? And that confuses people a little bit because it ignores the pure section because we're not doing anything to it. So I'll start with showing how to obtain the moments. Then I will launch into some as little as possible of the moment theory, because I tried doing this in the rehearsal yesterday and I ran out of time before I'd even got halfway through the moment theory. So I'm just going to go and say, okay, there's an algorithm. You put stuff in, you crank the handle, it will spit out an estimate. And if people really want to know more, then I can tell you afterwards. So how to do the partial transpose. So I'll shove this up here so you can see the basic idea. Now, I need a three-partite system now. So I'm going to have Alice, Bob, because I want to have them separated. I mean, I could go A, B, C, but you can do the bit that you trace out in the middle is kind of more general. So I'll start it with two spin chains to illustrate a point, which is relevant. Slightly fewer spins in each party, because otherwise this is going to go on forever. Right, so this is the initial pair of replicas before I decide to go and swap stuff around. Make sure I get this right this time. So two replicas, not necessarily the same. Now for the swap operation. All right, there's the other blank. Right, okay. Right, so that stays put, that stays put, that stays put, and that stays put because they're on the same subsystem. Now, where did I put the green chalk? Oh, let's have blue chalk. I forgot these in the middle. So those stay put as well. And then just get this right like that. So again, what I've done this time is I've swapped these two outer parts, because that's the only permutation you can do when you only have two objects. And so for this shows graphically that the second moment of the partial transpose of a density matrix is just the purity again. Right, they become different when you have three copies, which is the first one that you actually see a difference. So I'm going to try and do this with three copies now. And I'm going to do before and after again, because otherwise I'm not sure that this is going to be intelligible. So A, C, B. Is this big enough? Can people see? Right, stop me if it becomes illegible at any point.
Just yep. Check. The last board you were drawing, the replica trick for the trace of the row of the partial transpose squared, is that right?
Yeah, this is trace of row partial transpose squared. But that equals trace, if I put AB, that is trace AB squared. They're actually identical, simply because there's only one non-trivial permutation that you can do on two objects. Right? Now, once you have three objects, there is more than one non-trivial permutation that you can do, and they become distinct. So if I was doing the regular third order Renyi entropy, well, I should actually draw the darn thing before actually trying to explain that. One, two, three. One, two, three, five. So first two are the same as last time. And then another one. did I do this one like that? Okay, so those are my three copies before I decide to swap stuff about. Now, if I was doing the third order Renyi entropy, I would cyclically commute these in the same way. So if I call these 1, 2, 3, and I was doing the Renyi entropy, I would do the same permutation on both halves. So say 3, 1, 2, and then 3, 1, 2. Right? Now, if I'm doing the third moment of the partial transpose, I do something subtly different. And I'm never sure whether to draw this graphically first or manipulate indices first. So I'd be interested in people's opinion as to which is the better way of, what better order for presenting it. Trying to keep it concrete for people who are from a quantum Monte Carlo background, and I'm figuring that this might be clearer. But then again, maybe it isn't. Okay, so that stays put. 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 So these are the ones that are unchanged. And what I'm doing now is I'm doing permutations. So they're initially 1, 2, 3 again. And this one I'm going 3, 1, 2. But this one I'm going in the opposite direction, 2, 3, 1. And if that's totally confusing, I'll show you in a minute why that works. Good grief, right. Okay, so that's the diagram you get when you permute them in opposite directions. Everybody's staring at me. Okay, that's not helpful, right? Let's go back to density matrices. If I have, can I just drop that subscript because it's clutter. If I write the indices separately, so I'm going to do row indices downstairs and column indices upstairs, which is kind of a pedantic mathematician way of doing it. But there's a nice little isomorphism, which is much easier if you do it upstairs, downstairs. It's also useful mnemonic because then it behaves like indices in general relativity before you learn how to do it in index-free notation, back when you first meet it and you use indices everywhere until you get fed up with indices. So if I write these indices separately, so if I've got, if A is a D1 dimensional system and B is a D2 dimensional system, this number runs 0 to D1 or 1 to D1, and that goes 1 to D2, and that runs 1 to D1, and that runs 1 to D2. So if I have a 4x4 and I label the rows and columns in binary, right, I've automatically partitioned these indices. This is a more general version of this. Okay, now if I do the partial transpose on this, and this is the reason for divvying it up like that, all I do, all right, is swap those over. So this is just that. Right? Let's just bodily swap the vector and dual spaces. Now, if I'd done these with the same permutation, I don't find that helpful, right? It took me several goes when I was prepping this the first time to actually get that diagram right. I don't find it terribly helpful. If I write it out the way I would write it out, so I have three copies of row, and rather than sort of write out indices, we then get index plague. I'm just going to do this graphically by drawing them as little dots, because we're going to contract them all out. So when I draw a line, think Einstein's summation convention, those two indices have the same label. Is that okay? Right. Okay, so if I'm doing trace row cubed, Where's my some white chalk? Then I contract like this. Basically, the two indices follow each other around. You both treat both of them the same way. Nothing funky happens. Right, that's trace row cubed. So you have the same rule that you have with general relativity. You're always upstairs, downstairs pairs. And I contract them together by having them the same index with delta functions. Right, I'm too lazy to write out delta functions, so I just draw. Okay. Now, if I take the partial transpose, write this out again. Now, if I do the same one on the first index as before, that hasn't changed. So that goes like that. That's what I want. Now, if I swap these two, right, which is what you do when you do the partial transpose, right, what happens is that these now run backwards, because this now goes like that. Can you see? So this now goes like that. And this one goes the other way. So that now goes like that. And the odd one out that's now left behind is this one. That goes like that. So what you have is two contraflow cyclic permutations. Instead of having them all do the same cyclic permutation, you have one go that way and the other go that way. And that's it. So it's possible to get at the eigenspectrum for the partially transposed matrix without actually doing the partial transpose, which is a notoriously unphysical map. And there's a cute relationship between this and the circuit. Take that, rotate it, slap a control wire on it, and that gives you the circuit. All right. Right. So that's that's how I think of this. I mean, your mileage may vary, but you know, I personally find that easier to follow than this. All right. So is everybody clear about how that trick works? Right, good. So now, what are we doing for time? Okay, now we have that.
I have a very nice question, maybe a stupid question. So when you introduce the partial transpose, it was one bipartite system, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now you have a three-partite system.
Yep.
What's the role of C? So far what you presented is matrices that have indices running over
two parties,
A and B. But in principle, there's a subsystem C.
Yes, I've traced it out.
Where is that? You trace it out, but yes. It doesn't mean that you're basically taking the subsystem A and B into contact with each other?
No, doesn't have to.
Why not?
Because unless I actually put them so they interact, they're not in contact with each other. Right, I mean, I can just...
I can think of tracing out C as effectively integrating, say, some modes.
Right.
That generate some effective interaction between A and B, which in principle should be an effective boundary between A and B.
Okay, well, that's not what you're doing. You're just ignoring these things. Right, I mean, you ignore them here, you ignore the B subsystem here. And this one, you ignore C. I mean, you're familiar with the idea that you take a pure state and you trace bits of it out and you get left with something that's a mixed state subsystem. Right, now you can't access the bit you traced out, it can't tell you anything. Right, the only thing you can actually get at is a two-party subsystem that you're still holding. Right, now if you switch off your dynamics so your state is standing still, right, then it's just a fixed state. Now I don't know what you do with renormalization, but I mean when you're doing in this setting, when you trace something out, you just throw it away. Right, because I mean what we want to do understand. Right, I want to know here I have this thing, HIF thing, pull them apart, what's the entanglement doing between them? Right, because I want to specifically see the long range stuff. So if I do something which makes the rest of the lattice disappear in such a way that I brought these two together, right, that isn't answering my original question. It's answering a different question, which is a perfectly valid question, but it's not the one that we're focusing on here. Right, now I'm running short of time, so I need to... So somebody has already done Quantum Monte Carlo just for these moments. I can put a reference for that up if you want. That's by Chung et al., which is Andreas Laukli's group. And that's on archive 13121168. So properly worked out Monte Carlo, done properly for these moments. So you can actually use these things in quantum Monte Carlo as well as just circuit construction. Right, so let's skip that. So there's this thing, right, called the moment problem, which is a method for extracting partial information about eigenspectra when you don't have a full set of information, you just have the moments. Now, this is related to Laplace transform information, because the Laplace transform spits out moments the way the Fourier transform spits out frequencies, right? So I'm going to have to rub something out, and it's going to be, which shall I rub out? Probably this thing, I think. So this is originally functional analysis, but because of a nice feature of this, you can actually plug and play with matrices. Now, quite often when you say moment problem to people, they think in terms of maximum entropy methods, and you can do that, but it's not a good choice for the negativity. So known fact, if you try and use maximum entropy methods on negativity, it tends to lie to you. So what you want actually is the minimum value of the negativity consistent with the moments that you've just measured. Right, do I need to justify that assertion, or is it kind of obvious? I think it's kind of obvious, right, okay. So we want a method for extremizing that. Now, if I have partial information, then I get a set of solutions. We assume a solution exists at all, you get a set of the things. Unless the spectrum has got some really funny, really atypical properties, and you have a unique solution, right? In general rule, you know, you never see lower dimensional sets in the lab. So you either have a bunch of solutions or no solution. So you have a set, and I'm going to draw this as a kind of heuristic potato because it lives in infinite dimensions. heuristic potato diagram. So the boundary of that set, which is what we're going to want to look at, consists of distributions that are called atomic distributions. Now, you remember when you were first introduced to probability distributions, one of the things they teach you, if it's a continuous probability distribution, is that the weight at a point is always zero. Right? You can only talk about intervals. Right? That's not quite true. For things that are atomic distributions, you have a finite concentration of mass at a point. So these are discrete. Right? They're like delta functions. They're not quite, because they don't go all the way up to infinity. But you know, it's a spike-like thing. Right? And that's finite. Okay, now your boundary is made up of things that look like that. Now, I think it's a convex set. I think it's a convex cone or something. But we're only interested in the boundary for our purposes, so I didn't worry too much about exactly what goes on in the interior. Your max nth solution will live somewhere in here. But as I said, it's not actually helpful for what we want. Now, these have a nice property. I should probably tell you how the Markov problem works. The Markov problem is another thing that's not actually a problem because we know how to solve it. But historically, that's what it's called. Now, the Markov problem is I have a vaguely defined integral, right? These things live in a range. This is significantly better behaved if these are finite. For the purposes of negativity, a is minus 1/2, b equals 1. If we were trying to do this with a von Neumann entropy, we will be doing 0 and 1, and then we will be getting into trouble for other reasons. But you have an integral. This is some function that we want to extremize. This is a distribution, which is the mystery distribution we are attempting to find. So this can correspond to the spectrum subject to some small print, which I'll tell you about in a minute. And then the integral. So this whole thing together would be your measure of integration. That's the function that you're looking at. You don't know what this measure is. You only know that there is some set of possible sigma, right? Because that's all the information that you've got from the moments. So mystery distribution is sigma. This thing is a function that needs to satisfy some conditions. I'll do that function first and then explain the small print about the distribution. This thing can be various things. It needs to satisfy some conditions. There's a technical one which I'll come back to in a minute. It also needs to satisfy a convexity condition. That needs to be a convex function. It needs to have no singularities between A and B, because obviously everything kind of turns into a dumpster fire if you have singularities in the middle of it. It also, its first derivative needs to be well-behaved as well. You might be able to finesse that, but I haven't worked out how to do that yet. I'm still learning this. For example, omega lambda can be some lambda to some power, not necessarily integer, and that's fine if alpha is greater than or equal to 1, we can do that. If alpha is less than 0, we can't do it. Things blow up, you get a singularity. If it's alpha is between then you get a singularity in the first derivative. Probably not a good idea. You most certainly cannot have omega lambda equals log of lambda. You get things blow up at lambda equals 0. This is what makes your life difficult if you try and generalize this to the von Neumann entropy. And it also looks like you can't have this either. So that doesn't work, that doesn't work. Right, but for a large class of functions, the form of sigma which achieves the extrema is the same. So you can talk sensibly about this thing being an extremizing measure, right? Because provided omega satisfies these conditions, right, it doesn't actually matter what omega is, provided it satisfies those conditions. The name of the particular solution which achieves that extrema is called the lower principal representation, because you know, these are representations of the measures, these different sigmas, that's just what they're called. So the problem now reduces to find that. And that's where you have to start, that's where things start getting a little bit complicated. What am I? 3-1, 2-3-1. I'm going to take this out now. If we were just reconstructing the eigenspectrum of the density matrix itself, it would be pretty obvious what the next step was. The next step would be to go right. Just identify sigma and rho. This is called a density matrix. Now, this is a probability density, right? It's not a coincidence that they got very similar names. So if we were just doing eigenspectrum reconstruction, we would do that. We would then immediately follow the recipe, which I'm going to give you in a minute, hopefully. It tells you how to find the lower principal representation, and we will be good to go. We cannot do that with rho partial transpose. I keep dragging this around. I'm treating this thing as a function of lambda, but that's just because the thing is set up like that. Right, because we're limiting ourselves to the atomic distributions, your integrals are really summations. You cannot do this because this thing's not positive semi-definite. And while you can sort of bend the rules a little bit with the Markov problem to some extent, one thing you cannot do is have this thing be not positive semi-definite. Google found me a paper where some mathematicians tried to allow this thing to be not positive semi-definite, and the result was basically an under-constrained train wreck. So you can't do that. Omega, on the other hand, as you might have guessed from the fact that what I've written and the fact that A is allowed to be negative, omega can go negative, and that distinction is important. So we've got a problem. We can't just plug and play. There's a trick, which is kind of implicit in the definition. So I've written, been writing this blithely, right? Right, just the multiplicity. I can define an M primed right, I can just move things around, right, and then change the index for when I write down my moments. So if that was originally multiplicity lambda I to the n, right, I just shift that. So if I then go, everything is actually the same, I've just relabeled something. Can you see that? I've just multiplied through by lambda. So I got this freedom. Now, in the moment problem literature, that's called shifting. It has nothing to do with a shift operator in quantum information theory. They're completely different animals. So having done that, what we can do is we can shift it in one or two directions. Now, the obvious thing to do is to try doing this. Just square it up. Unfortunately, you can't do that because when you try and get back to the spectrum of the original partially transposed density matrix, you find yourself trying to use an illegal omega, right? You end up trying to use, which blows up. So you can't do that. So instead, you go in the other direction and you define a, what am I going to rub out? A counting function, basically, which is a kind of zeroth moment, and you define that to be sum right, and of course anything to the zero is one, so this is actually just the sum, it just counts the multiplicities, it's literally a counting function. Okay, so how does that help? Well, got a whole load of blackboard here that I'm not using. There's some existence conditions for whether or not you actually have a solution. So if I write this up here again, so people can keep track of what stuff is. A and B are the limits of integration. And we've decided to backshift this. So right, and you can treat that I as a kind of discretized version of lambda because you just have a discrete distribution. It's an atomic distribution. So if you think about this, you're going to see that what your existence conditions are actually going to depend on how many constraints you've got. So if you have an even number of constraints, which way around did I do this? Even number of constraints, including the fictional moment that you've just written down, the existence condition right, so this is some matrix. You write this. I've written it like this, but this is actually write it out as a matrix. This is just a condensed notation for that. So you have to satisfy these two conditions. And you want k equals 0 to n. And obviously the zero is kind of trivial, but oh yeah. all important, that has to be bigger than zero. So when I take the determinant, by abusive notation, right, that's zero. It's got to be bigger than zero. So those are those two matrices. Their determinants have to be greater than or equal to zero. Your edge case occurs when it's exactly zero. And there's something kind of similar. Oh, that's the problem with not having with having a one that goes behind. It's just lousy backdoor technique, my apologies. So that one has to be bigger than zero when you take its determinant. And this one's a bit gnarlier. So take the determinant of those two both have to be greater than or equal to zero. So in practice, one or other of them is the one that is the tighter condition, and that's the one that is the one that actually defines what mu naught is. So what happens is you end up with some matrix that you filled out according to that recipe, right, and your mu naught always lands in the top left-hand corner, sometimes on its own, sometimes subtracted from something else, da-da-da. But when you take a determinant, there is a lower bound on how big that has to be, but no upper bound. So mu naught can be as large as it likes, but there's a minimum value, and if it goes below that, then this determinant of thing drops below zero. So you can get a lower bound from mu naught, but not an upper bound. So, this thing is supposed to be, is everybody happy about that, how that trick works? You just take the existence conditions and use them to constrain your count. So this thing can already tell you how many non-zero eigenvalues it needs just from these equations here. Now, of course, we didn't actually tell the mathematics that mu naught is an integer. So in general, it won't be. So what you do with that is you bump it up to the next integer. So you want the smallest integer that's bigger than whatever threshold gets spat out of that determinant. And this is actually not a bug, it's a feature, because if you're right on the edge of that existence condition, you've got something that's going to be numerically badly behaved because you've got singular matrices and it's generally going to be stroppy and very sensitive to statistical noise. If you bump this up a little bit, then it becomes stable again in that you have a non-zero number of, you have a non-unique solution. It's what's known as strictly positive. In the definition of the moment literature, if you have an instance which is, in which these determinants are greater than zero, that's strictly positive. If they're exactly zero, that's singularly positive. Singularly positive is the true edge case, but it's also awkward because it's singular, right? It's going to be a pain about statistical noise. So you're better off making it slightly strictly positive. Okay, because I've already clear about how that trick works. I mean, obviously, if you're trying to do a continuum limit, you don't want to nudge this because if you're treating it as an honest-to-goodness probability distribution, everything's continuous, then you know this thing is back to not having to be an integer. But well, we're dealing with real matrices here because we're thinking finite systems, even if they're large. Quantum Monte Carlo still lives in finite systems. Right? Okay, so now we've got an estimate for mu naught. There are these things called the characteristic equations which tell you what the roots are in this, in these representations. So you've got this thing, you've got runs from minus a half, one, because it's a known fact that the largest negative eigenvalues can get is minus one half. And you've got some spikes somewhere, right? And those are characterized by some eigenvalues, which are called roots. And then their heights, which are called weights, right? So what you do is there's some things that are called characteristic equations, although they're different from what you or I would normally call, certainly what I would call a characteristic equation. Right? When I call a characteristic equation for the matrix, the usual thing, you take determinant of matrix minus lambda I solve for lambda, right? Okay. These things in the literature are called characteristic equations. They're not the standard layout. Hey, it works. you know, I don't want to give a miniature course in functional analysis because it will take hours, literally. So we don't want to do that. Now, what can I rub out? This? Or how about get rid of that? I think I made the point about the Markov problem, so we can ditch that. So for the so-called well-constrained case, this is when your largest eigenvalue is, now what is it? Odd, I think, yes. Right, so your largest moment is odd-powered moment. So you solve this thing. Now, partial transpose is a trace-preserving map, so this thing is actually one. So here is M. Right, and N is such that this gives you a sensible number, right? No. So that is your largest moment that you have. Right, so this is something that turns up in the moment a problem literature quite a lot. You have, this thing is actually a square matrix when you include these, so it has a determinant that's non-trivial. You quite often get stuff of the form matrix, something bolted on the side of it, such that the overall object is square. Now you set this up, solve it for values of lambda. Those lambdas are your roots. There's an analogous one for the ill-constrained case, which is slightly under-constrained. You've either got one too many constraints or one too few, depending how you look at it, so I call it the ill-constrained case. That's a bit messier. I can write it out if people want to see it. I'm less inclined to trust the ill-constrained case, but for reasons. But anyway, you take this. Once you've got these lambdas, you can plug that back into your original equations for your moments. All right. Right, this is your moments that you actually have. And you can then solve for these. And by choosing the labeling the way I have, I've implicitly undone the backshift. So I'm now back in my original labeling for the moments. So you just solve that. It's just a linear system of equations. It might be a little bit ornery because of the way these things scale, but you know, it's standard Gaussian elimination. I should probably ought to put the ill-posed ones as well. I'm going to have to rub this out. Where did I put all the board rubbers? Right up there. So for the ill-posed case, the ill-constrained case, one of your roots for the extremal canonical distributions and also for the principal representations, for the lower principal representation, that has to be there. There has to be one root that's pinned at the lower limit. And that's because for reasons to do with how this is set up, which I am not going to go into. These polynomials that it spits out are non-negative, which means that they must have, depending on how many roots they have, if you have an even number of roots, those are going to be either degenerate roots in the interior of the range or a pair, one at each end. If you've got an odd number of roots, one of them has to be pinned to the end, because otherwise it can't be positive, you can't cross the line, and the others are going to be in degenerate pairs. Now, if you think about it, that actually makes sense, because you're looking for the boundary of the set in which your polynomials have real solutions, right? And the last thing that polynomial roots do before they go complex is they become degenerate, right? They both sit on the real line, and then once they go complex, you get a dip that doesn't actually hit the zero line, right? So this thing goes fishing for distributions of that form. Now you might say, well, what happens if my true eigenspectrum actually doesn't have that form and all my eigenvalues are distinct? How does it do that? Well, what it does is it finds a set of distributions which is slightly too big, because remember, this thing doesn't know that it's dealing with matrices. It's going to treat this as functions. So it gives you, will typically return weights, these MIs, which are not integers, right? It gets out of the fact, because, I mean, if you say to it, right, I'm not going to allow you to have an imaginary part, it's now got half as many degrees of freedom that it needs to have. And the way it gets its full set of degrees of freedom back is to relax the constraint on the weights being integers. Now, that seems like a rather strange thing to do unless you thought about optimization problems. Integer-constrained optimization problems are generally hard. A common technique for simplifying them is to approximate them by relaxing the integer constraints and allowing them to take continuous values. Right? It's a bit of a hack, but it often works, and it can often simplify it. You get an approximation, you don't get an exact solution, but that might be good enough for whatever it is you want to do with it. So that's why this thing is the shape. That's why there is this object out here. And then all right, dots again. And then the bottom line is, so here, these are single entries. I should maybe put brackets around this, having found the textbook confusing because it didn't. So solve that, that spits out the roots. The roots are implicitly in degenerate pairs. And then once again, you solve the set of system, your system of coupled linear equations. So there's a weight here on that. Right, now, if we're thinking matrices, we would expect these to be integers. Now, of course, they won't be because we didn't put that constraint in. This hints at, you know, clearly this is not going to be an exact approximation most of the time, because most of the time your true eigenspectrum, unless you're very lucky and you have the right pattern of degeneracies, your true eigenspectrum is not going to be that shape. Right, so you can't approximate this thing exactly in an efficient way. This is kind of hinting at the algorithmic complexity of doing a more accurate approximation, right, via this integer constrained versus continuously constrained thing. So once you have that, that's how you extract the representation. And then you notice something else, again to do with, I'm going to have to rub that out. I am. Now, if I sketch the behavior of what the lower principal reps look like for the corresponding polynomials that you're pulling out. They're actually called evaluation polynomials, but we don't particularly. Now, for the lower principal rep for the well-constrained case, what you end up with, you have a bunch of roots which are in the interior. Okay. The ill-constrained one you cross here and there, but we don't want to deal with. The upper principal representation, which we're not going to use, has them cross here. You don't want to mix that with the back step because basically it doesn't work. It's not defined. It blows up and there's no way of getting it to deal with that. Now this thing, it parks its roots, one of them on the endpoint, and then some in the interior. So this one is positive because it goes like that. Right? Now, this thing is an approximation, well, it's a coarse graining of an eigenspectrum. Where did I put the colored chalk? I think I left one here. So this is our coarse graining of the eigenspectrum. We've got some stuff here, right? Now, if just we're dealing with a negativity, this is minus 1/2. This is plus 1. Unless we have additional information about the system which tells us we can restrict that. If you have additional information that tells you that tighter limits on that, you should definitely use it because it will improve your estimates significantly. So I've just said, oh yeah, solve this entire linear equation. Because you only want the negative eigenvalues, you actually only need to find the weights for the negative eigenvalues. You can be lazy and just eliminate the others. So that makes it slightly simpler. But you'll notice something about the lower principal representation is it's cramming all its eigenspectrum over here. Right? Now, for a lot of things, that will give you a lower bound, but for the negativity, that's the condition for it to be maximal. So actually, for the ill-constrained case, the lower principal rep gives you the maximum, not the minimum. And the reason why that happens is actually to do with the other fiddly technical condition on omega that I left out. Sometimes when you have to, technical widget called a T-system. So if your moments form a T-system, which they will do, because the original archetypal T system was a set of power moments. And in fact, I can be a non-integer provided your different values are distinct. So if I have mu to the alpha, right, set of these, and alpha starts from, well, alpha 1 is, that has to be greater than or equal to 0, I think. Right, so what we did, because we have a bunch of power moments going up to lambda to whatever it is, and we are sticking our, what you do is you have your, I'm trying to avoid writing out the big gnarly determinant. If you have your moments which are a nice T system, what you do is you ask, if I extend my set by my omega, is that still a T-system, right? And then sometimes it's a T-system, but it's out of order. So if you put it back in order, and this is the case here because omega is just lambda that we've used implicitly here. If you put them back in order, you've done a permutation on the set. If that permutation is even, it's not going to change the value of this determinant that I'm avoiding writing out. If it's odd, then it does flip it. And when that happens, you reverse the upper and lower principal representations. So your lower principal rep actually gives you the maximum. So quite unexpectedly, this thing gives you, I mean, when I was doing this, I was expecting it to only give me lower bounds. And then realized at the last minute that the ill-constrained lower principal representation actually spits out a maximum. So we kind of got that for free. I mean, I can write out that determinant if you really want to see it, but it's kind of not terribly enlightening. So the question is, does this thing change sign anywhere over this range? If the answer is no, then it's a T-system. But it says specifically change sign, not must be positive, right? And so when you reorder that, it can go negative, but the whole thing goes negative. Now, how overrun am I? Only 15 minutes or 10 minutes. That is, I think, the end of it. Has anybody got any questions? It's a recipe. The reason why is gnarly functional analysis, but actually, if you just want to plug and play, the recipe that you end up doing is defined in terms of a determinants and some polynomials. Is everybody totally confused? Do I need to write out a bunch of matrices instead of skipping over stuff? Any questions?
You finished?
I'm finished, yeah.
Well, in that case.
Right.
Now I'll officially ask for questions. So maybe I have one. I guess I did get a little bit confused. So by doing all this moment theory stuff, which I don't pretend to completely understand, you're saying I'm getting some polynomials, the roots of which tell me where some of the eigenvalues are.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they give you the extremal spectrum. In general, it's not going to look anything like the actual spectrum. The fact that these weights are not integers is kind of a dead giveaway that it's not the actual spectrum, unless you're very, very lucky. Now, if it just so happens that your real spectrum really does look like this, it will find it exactly. Right, but generically it won't.
Right, so the picture is I've done my Monte Carlo simulation, I've managed to estimate using that some of the moments. I've plugged this into this moment theory governance, and I've got what you say, the coarse graining of the spectrum. So you said that I am guaranteed to get an upper bound and a lower bound.
Yeah, lower bound was what I was originally going for. It just so happens that because of this role reversal, you get an upper bound from the ill constraint case.
Is it obvious that, where is it clear that I'm definitely getting a bound? So how do I know that these eigenvalues are anything close to, how do I know there are some of the negative ones rather than just, one negative one and all the rest are positive?
Really
getting intuition.
Okay, well, I mean, if you've got a system with a non-zero distillable entanglement, you will get some negative ones and some positive ones. If everything comes out positive for the lower bound, all the eigenvalues come out positive for that, then you don't have any distillable entanglement. You might have bound entanglement, but you don't have distillable entanglement. You shouldn't take these too literally. When I say coarse graining, I mean coarse graining good enough that you can evaluate or estimate functions like a negativity. Right? I think it would be sort of dangerous to say, here is my spectrum. Right? If you're in the case when you're doing the continuum limit and you have all the moments and you can zip it up using the Stilch's transform, then you can get an exact spectrum. And I mean, somebody's already done that after that paper came out for a particular system. So you there is a continuum limit.
The other thing I was worried about is whether there are cases where there might be a non-zero negativity, but I don't see it because of the incomplete reconstruction of the spectrum. Is that possible, or can I definitely?
No. I mean, I've skipped over all the proof for why the lower principal representation does, in fact, achieve that minimum. Okay. I mean, in general, it won't be tight. Right, so I mean, you may find, for example, that it falsely reports that there is no negativity, and in fact, a correct calculation would reveal that it does have a non-zero negativity. It's a lower bound. It won't be tight unless you just so happen to have a spectrum which is, only has a few distinct eigenvalues with massive degeneracies. Now, you might get that in some topologically ordered system. In general, you won't get anything like that. So, I mean, you shouldn't take it too literally as a reconstruction, especially when you only have a few moments. But if all you want is an estimate, you can rule distillable entanglement in or out. But I mean, if your upper bound comes back as zero, you have no distillable entanglement.
So the key thing is I still have a smoking gun for,
yes. Right, so if the lower bound says you have a non-zero negativity, then you definitely have a non-zero negativity.
And the question which I asked before privately, so have you tried this out on some systems?
Well, we sort of tried. I mean, there's a small system that Roger and Chris Herdman and Dmitry Yuchenko and somebody whose name I should remember but don't, I think it might have been Adrian Del Maestro, looked at, you know, a small system inspired by the paper by Rajabul Islam and co, looking at trapped atoms and trying to measure the Renyi entropy and that, and they did an analysis on that. And so we thought, hey, you know, this is small enough to do by exact diagonalization, because you want a system that you can do by exact diagonalization, because you want to evaluate the true value of the negativity and then check whether these estimates converge. Now, if you think about it, from the fact that this thing forces an assumption about the shape of the eigenspectrum that it has to be in degenerate pairs, they're not going to actually meet the true value unless the true spectrum, the true negativity spectrum happens to be of that form. But you can see that they are, in fact, sort of zoning in on it. And we had a kind of an embarrassing problem in that when we actually ran it, we found that we had so few algebraically independent moments that we could have done it using the old 2003 paper. you know, which I blithely said, oh, yeah, you know, in real systems, you're going to have loads of moments, and if you only get a few of them, then the old 2003 paper isn't going to work. And so I kind of, it was an unexpected failure mode, is that the earlier CRUDA paper actually worked just fine, and it therefore wasn't a difficult enough system to really test this thing properly.
But it's not a real failure mode, it still works.
No, I mean, it works. But, I mean, the thing is, the 2003 paper, if it works perfectly.
Right.
If it fails, then it sprays complex numbers at you and tells you nothing worth having.
So you haven't tested on a system where your previous method doesn't work yet.
Right. Whereas this thing will always give you an answer which is not completely nuts, but it won't hit it. It won't give you the exact answer unless your spectrum happens to be of that form. Right. So you know you've got either something. It's either exact or fails catastrophically, versus always gives you an approximation but won't give you the exact answer unless it just happens to be an atypical case. So I mean, what we're planning to do is find a system which is sufficiently gnarly that the 2003 paper would need a prohibitively large number of moments, and then check whether this thing converges properly. So it's got to be small enough you can do it by exact diagonalization so that we can calculate the negativity exactly, and then see whether these things do in fact converge, because there's a family of these things, right? I mean, so you will have a set that sort of, a set of lower bounds which should approach the true value and a set of upper bounds which should approach it from above. But because of the form forced on the spectrum by the way it's done, right? Real systems, and there's, you know, unless you're very lucky, a real system won't have that shape, so it can't hit it.
Yeah. And that's
worked with Roger. Yeah, I mean, we're still choosing the system at this stage. I mean, I said to him, oh, when he said to me, oh yeah, Hubbard model, you have infinitely, so your Hilbert space is infinite dimensional. I thought, all right, that should be plenty big enough, right? And then we found out that actually you've only got like 4 or 5 algebraically independent moments of the partially transposed density matrix, and that setting you can use the 2003 paper. What we were hoping for is something like, I don't know, 20 odd algebraically independent moments for the partial transpose, because then you've got enough wriggle room in it to actually see whether it's converging or not, right? Whereas this thing was like 1, 2, and done. Okay, well, yeah, that's cute, but it's not actually informative.
Well, is there any further questions?
Thank you
very much.